Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 18th of April. And we're going to talk about space. A lot of interesting news from space. We celebrated just last week, April 12, the Soviet Union's own giant leap for mankind, one that would spur a humiliated United States to a race for the moon. It happened 50 years ago last week when an Air Force pilot named Yuri Gagarin became the first human in space. There were big demonstrations. There were big celebrations in London about this. And it was a pretty big deal. So we'll look at that anniversary. We'll talk about this wonderful program that's going on. One of our guests is involved in this, and it is planethunters.org. It's allowing people like us who are not trained to be astronomers to make some important discoveries about potential planets. One of our guests will also tell us what's in the spring sky and what kinds of news in space that maybe they're not really aware of, because I think people who have space news need to let us know more about what's happening, and so we can read all about it or talk all about it. We have two guests with us this hour. Our guests are Professor Deborah Fisher, a professor of astronomy with an emphasis on the detection and characterization of exoplanets. She is at Yale University, and she is co-creator of Planet Hunters. In case you are close to the internet and you want to go to planethunters.org, do that, and you can become involved in this project and may become a person who has discovered the next planet. Who knows? We thank you very much, Professor Fisher, for joining us.
Thanks so much, Kathleen, for having me.
Oh, yeah, it's our great pleasure. And you will be on with Alan Pesch, who's a friend of ours. And we had the great pleasure, I think a couple years ago now, of going to the Barlow Planetarium and seeing the program that they put on. And subsequently, we've spoken with Alan on many shows about the skies. Alan, thank you for joining us again.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, nice to have you here. Let's start, if you don't mind, both of you, with this anniversary of Yuri Gagarin in space 50 years ago, and what kind of competition it sparked between the United States and the Soviet Union. Well, Chrissy and I were talking about him this morning. This is an incredible thing for a human being to do. He had no idea if he'd make it or not, and being out there on his own for the first human being to go into space was really a giant leap. But what do you know about what he was thinking about all of this? Deborah?
Well, I think that this, of course, was a very exciting occurrence that launched and fueled the whole space program for the United States. And the sort of spinoffs in terms of the science that we've had have been amazing. So I'm not sure what was in his mind or how the Soviets were thinking. I'm sure it was very competitive that they wanted to outdo us and really reach out into space, and they succeeded.
Yeah, they did. Do you think we were humiliated, Alan?
I think we were, but I think that at a certain level, but as Dr. Fisher said, it caused a growth in science and technology and mathematics that is almost unparalleled even to today's standards. In fact, indirectly, I have a job because what the Russians did back with Sputnik and Gagarin launching, they started this push in technology that allowed this little planetarium to be built on this little campus in Menasha, Wisconsin, in 1961, which now I have the next generation of that planetarium here. So it was this huge technological leap, where a lot of great things, not just space, happened in a very short period of time.
Yeah, it sure did. And if you compare now, both of you, the amount of attention that we give to space, the amount of resources, are we half of where we were when Yuri Gagarin sparked this competition? Or are we comparable in terms of devoting resources to space exploration? Deborah?
Well, I think there's no doubt that we're sort of light years ahead of where we were, 50 years ago. NASA has really expanded the science that they do, the research that they do, and the discovery of planets, you know, has been possible just because people were excited by that whole event, all of the 1960s, Apollo landers and so forth. So I think it's been phenomenal. And people still look back, you know, on the 1960s as the glory days when the United States was in the space race.
Mm-hmm. We hear, and both of you hear this, so let me ask it right off the bat here. Some people will say, you know, what's the point of doing all of this? We have so many problems here on Earth that we need to deal with, healthcare reform and huge deficits, et cetera. Why in the world are we giving resources to send telescopes out in space to help us determine whether or not there are other planets? What difference does it make? Alan?
Well, when we look at the type of money spent, and it is large money spent toward NASA. However, the returns are dramatic of any program that has ever been federally funded. You can look, depending on whose research you look at, it's anywhere from $10 to $15 to sometimes $20 that comes out of that program for every federal dollar we put into the program. So it has scientists, it's high-paying jobs, it's people paying taxes who are working in those high-paying jobs, and all that stuff just keeps increasing and building up so these economies can actually function a lot better. And the nice thing is everything we touch today has some contact with the space program at some level that was developed, whether our clocks are more accurate, whether we are having pumps for patients getting heart surgery. All these things have been developed for certain purposes at NASA and then sent out into the private sector to help our everyday lives a lot better. Try to find somebody who doesn't have a GPS receiver in their car nowadays.
Right, exactly. It is amazing all that touches our personal lives. We just don't. I don't think people who work in space tout their accomplishments as much as they probably should. Do you want to add to that, Professor Fisher?
Definitely. So this is something I feel pretty passionate about. If you look at how much money is spent on NASA and the National Science Foundation, it's actually a relatively small slice of the budget. It sounds like a big number when you look at it, but it's sort of comparable to the bailout of the banks. And I think if you know, people were really serious about ending hunger in the world and so forth, you know, we could look at other places. The DOD, for example, has a huge slice of the budget. But the, as Alan said, the technological spinoffs from the space program have been incredible. And they include, you know, satellites that are orbiting the Earth. So basically everything you do that, you know, connects to a satellite is a spinoff of the space program, and that includes cell phones and televisions and, you know, in any kind of receivers, GPS satellites, as Alan said. So we're much further ahead in the last 50 years than we would have been without the space program.
Let's talk about the Kepler satellite, because it's allowed you to do the kinds of work that you're doing and just ordinary citizens to become involved in your project. When Kepler went up, what its mission is, and how it has revolutionized the search for planets around other stars. Whoever wants to start.
Sure, I can jump in if you like. So I've been looking for planets orbiting other stars since the late 1990s, and the technique that I use is actually different from the one that Kepler uses, but collectively, astronomers in the United States, in fact, in the world, have discovered more than 500 planets orbiting other stars with ground-based telescopes. And then in March of 2009, the Kepler spacecraft was launched, and the idea was for the satellite to stare at one part of space and look unblinkingly at a set of actually over 3 million stars. And from that 3 million stars, there was some cherry-picking that was done on the very best targets. And now we look at something, or the Kepler team is looking at something like 150,000
wow.
of those stars, and watching for a tiny dimming in the brightness of the star. And you can imagine that that would happen if a planet, which is fairly dark, were to pass in its orbit in front of the star, blocking out a little bit of starlight. And so that's what the Kepler mission has done. And it's succeeded, I think, beyond my wildest expectations. The team announced after just 1 year something like 700 planet candidates that were found, and then just last February upgraded that to now over 1,200 planets that have been found. We've been working hard on the ground for 15 years and found something like 500. And so the fact that Kepler has, you know, more than tripled that number is really impressive.
And what is it that the human eye can see that the volunteers are being able to make these breakthroughs in science that the telescope can't see? How are we advancing this?
Sure. Well, the telescope is collecting the data, and it beams the data down roughly every month to the Kepler team then picks up the data, and they have computer algorithms that are analyzing this data. The data that I'm talking about consists of measurements of the brightness of 150,000 stars, and these measurements are taken every 30 minutes, you know, 24/7 for the last 2 years. And the Kepler team has kindly released into the public archive now more than 120 of the first days of data. So what we are doing, you know, as soon as I saw the data and how complex the data were, it struck me that this might be a good citizen science project because the computer algorithms will do whatever we tell them to do. But the diversity of the data was so incredible. And the number of, frankly, you know, there are glitches, there are changes in the temperature of the detector and so forth that cause weird data glitches. And these are going to definitely stump the computer algorithms. And so our thought was that human beings looking at these light curves would pretty quickly be trained to figure out when a transit was occurring and would mark those for us. And now we're looking at the database from all of the users, and we verify them first. We run several checks and then bounce them by the Kepler team. And, you know, already hundreds of candidates that the Kepler team had, you know, the computer algorithms had missed are being detected by planet hunters.
Oh, but how do you deal? Earlier on, you were talking about looking at all of these stars without blinking, that the telescope does that. What about human beings? We blink.
So fortunately, the telescope has done all of that hard work for us.
Oh.
So if you look at the planethunters.org website, what you'll see is a measurement. It's a plot. It's a graph. We've tried to make it look as pretty as possible, as unintimidating as possible. but you'll see that there are measurements in the brightness of a star. And when the planet goes in front of the star, that brightness decreases a little bit.
I see.
And then it brightens again after the planet passes by in maybe, you know, 2 or 3 or even 15 hours, depending on its orbit. And so that's what we're having people look for, are these dips in the brightness of the star that occur like clockwork, because a planet's orbit is just like clockwork. And so that's one of the things that the human brain can quickly pick up. Is this signal repeating? You know, does it look like a transit signal? So we weren't sure. It was an experiment. We weren't sure that people would be good at looking at this kind of data, and they've been incredibly successful.
Alan, I would imagine this would be so perfect for people who come to the Barlow Planetarium and want to get involved in helping further the cause of science and space exploration. To actually do a hands-on task like this would be wonderful.
Well, and this sort of thing has been happening around. For those of us who are old enough to remember when the search for extraterrestrial intelligence used to allow you to set up a screensaver on your machine, and when you weren't using it, it was actually using the CPU power of your computer to crunch numbers looking for signals possibly coming from alien life forms. The more eyes you have looking at something, it will let you crunch, at least get through the first level of data so much quicker, which will allow the discoveries to occur. And also, the technology in Kepler is just amazing, because you're looking at technology that wasn't possible a generation ago. And now, I've heard numbers of Kepler, like you could show it 1,000 light bulbs and unscrew one light bulb, and Kepler would be able to tell you that one light bulb was out.
Oh, isn't that something?
This is stuff that if you talk to any astronomer in the last few generations, they're probably saying, of course there were planets out there. And they also understood that we couldn't see them because we're looking at stars that are so much brighter and they're tough to detect. Now we get to this technology where now that number has just blossomed, literally, thanks to this technology we put up with the Kepler spacecraft.
Yeah. Professor Fisher, how do you verify If somebody out there is a volunteer with the project and they think they found the real thing, how do you verify whether or not a planet has been discovered?
Right. So that's really complicated, not only for us, but also for the Kepler team. And so what we do is we extract every single transit event that users mark is extracted from the data set. And the great thing is that this project is really a sort of what we call wisdom of the crowds project. And so if one person were to vote that they saw a transit event, then it actually wouldn't count for very much. But we have many people looking at the light curves. And, you know, if the majority of the people flag this or, you know, significant fraction flag an event as a transit, then we pull it out of the database and we actually have a sort of a tier of scrutiny that's applied then to the transits. I first line up a set of undergraduates who are looking through all of the data, and they decide whether or not, you know, the event is consistent with the transit. And then finally it comes up to myself and my grad students and postdocs who say, yeah, that really looks intriguing. And then we send it to the Kepler team, and we sent them our top 10, for example, a few weeks ago, and they came back and said all 10 of them passed our data verification.
Oh, my.
So that's the process. It's actually quite labor-intensive.
And, of course, those of us who are listening to all of this keep thinking sometime in our lifetime we would sure like to think that there is there are the conditions for life forms that could communicate somehow with us, that extraterrestrial life that you were talking about, Alan. Do you have any idea that that's a possibility in the work that both of you are doing, that we're going to find something soon that can somehow communicate with us?
Well, Kepler is looking for small planets. It's for the older ways of discovering these exosolar planets. We're discovering planets that were huge, like Jupiters and Saturns, or even larger. And we know from our own limited experience in this one little star of hundreds of billions in our galaxy that those types of planets aren't suitable for life. They're too cold, they're gaseous. And now Kepler has this ability to find these smaller planets that aren't too far away from the sun, aren't too close to the sun, what we like to call the Goldilocks zone, just like Earth is, where the water's not frozen and it's not all boiled away. And there has been several candidates that Kepler has discovered that are in that zone. They're in the right area where the temperature of the planet would actually be okay for life. We don't know if all the other stuff is okay for life, but we definitely know these planets are probably not way too hot and not way too cold. So it's going to happen sometime. But boy, is it imminent? Maybe, maybe not. We're still very far away from these objects. So even if we found out today and sent a message to them, it'd still take maybe generations or centuries for our signal to get there.
Right. Your thoughts on this, Professor Fisher?
Well, Alan has captured this really nicely. The way I see Kepler is that it's one cornerstone in what is really a very large, has to be a large search. And it's a search not for planets, but it really is a search for life. And so what Kepler, the biggest contribution, I think, that Kepler is making is to tell us something about the statistics of these small planets in the what we call the habitable zone, as Alan's described. And once we know that 1 in 10 stars has Earth-like planets at Earth-like distances, then we can tailor the next generation of spacecraft to actually start going up and looking, you know, at distant stars and trying to block out the starlight and image the pale blue dot that's orbiting that star. And so I think our best hope for finding life, unfortunately, not technological life, I mean, this we're casting a slightly wider net here, is to begin taking spectra of the atmospheres of planets around nearby stars and looking for signs of life. Because one of the things that life did on Earth long before there was any technology was the early cyanobacteria on Earth, which contaminated the atmosphere of the Earth, lucky for us, contaminated it with oxygen. And so we'll go and we'll begin looking at atmospheres of other planets, I think, in the next decade, and searching for signs of this pollution by life, things like oxygen and methane and ozone.
It's phenomenal. Let's go to phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. We're talking about space, significant anniversaries, significant projects that have a volunteer element, and you just heard about what's going on with Kepler and finding new planets and how you can get involved in that. We also have yet to talk about the spring sky. It's a winter sky today, but it's spring. It really is spring, and so we can talk about some of the things that we can see in the sky. We always like to do these shows so we have an idea of the sky for a month or a couple months. We do them every couple months. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We have two guests with us. Alan Pesch is director of the Barlow Planetarium, and it's a wonderful place if you haven't been there. They also have a lot. This would be a fun thing to do in the summertime. They have a lot of programs for young people. They have a great feature show going on now, Ring World, and Bear Tales and other grisly stories coming up. We'll ask Alan to talk about that. But they also have classes, registration for people in completed grades 3 to 5 and 4 to 6 and 5 to 8, which sound just wonderful. Wouldn't it be fun to go to one of the classes this summer at Barlow? To your phone calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn. Deborah Fisher, also our guest, professor of astronomy with an emphasis on the detection and characterization of exoplanets. She's at Yale University and is co-creator of Planet Hunters, which you can find at planethunters.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now. Let's start with Daryl from Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Kathleen and your guests.
Hi, Daryl.
I have a two-part question. Is NASA a subsidiary of the U.S. government? And if so, which department does it come under? Or do foreign governments or corporations hold input or control over its operation or specific projects or programs?
Deborah.
So NASA is definitely run by the U.S. government. The research that's supported is supported for U.S. astronomers, U.S. researchers, and none of the money actually goes to foreign researchers. So if I have colleagues who are in another country, for example, they're welcome to participate in the research, but they're not eligible for funding. So let's see, you asked what subsidiary it was, and I'm not sure I know the answer to that question.
Ellen, do you have anything to add?
I think sometimes, especially with NASA, especially recently with the International Space Station, I think that kind of got a little blurred, but we have to remember that NASA, the U.S. agency, is a part of a team of 16 different countries that are working on the space station. So although our vehicles did a lot of the heavy lifting to get the components of the space station up there, and other countries did put stuff on our shuttle to take up to the International Space Station, it is all United States, and I'm not sure what section it's under either. However, I think the VP is probably the leader of the or watches over NASA mostly.
What do both of you think about the retirement of the space shuttles, Professor Fisher?
Well, the idea was that the space shuttle would be retired and we would move on to other flight vehicles. I think, you know, it's a bit of a worry that with the current financial status, that might not happen, that we might end up having a gap. And so that will make it more difficult to service, for example, things like the Hubble Space Telescope, which is due to retire anyway, but, you know, other satellites and to carry out some good science. So I think it's, if we were really moving on to the next flight vehicle, then that would be fine. But it would be sad if there's a real gap.
Ellen?
I agree. I mean, I understand that the shuttles are aged. They started flying. We just experienced their 30th anniversary a week ago of the first flight of Columbia. And I agree that I wish there was another vehicle ready to fly in its wings, because currently all our crews will be taken up by the Russian Soyuz craft. There is a company on the horizon called SpaceX, which is doing some really cool and very impressive returns on what they've been doing. They've already put something into orbit. They've already have flight plans to fly by the International Space Station, and hopefully by next year, maybe at the end of this year, we will start supplying some things to the International Space Station using the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket and the Dragon capsule.
This is a government program or a private company?
This is a completely private program. Huh. They're launching stuff at about half the price.
Really?
So they're taken into the safety and everything, but in fact, I'll post some pictures on our Facebook page.
Please.
Some impressive stuff. They landed so close to the coast of California, you can see mountains in the background. And they're pretty convinced that they can bring this Dragon capsule down within 1 square mile.
Huh. I would imagine you have to be very careful, though, if private companies are going out there. Don't they have to be regulated in some way by the government to make sure they're not hitting other space capsules or space junk? Or is it safe for all of them?
It is, and they have to fly through, pardon the pun, a lot of hoops to make sure everything is safe.
Right.
And especially docking with the space station. And when they eventually get to that point, imagine giving your car keys to a 16-year-old driver and parking a Ferrari out on the driveway and basically saying,
right,
practice parallel parking around
right,
the Ferrari.
Right, exactly.
But they're going to have to do some stuff. They're going to have to make sure safety is taken into account and all that other stuff. But this is very impressive that a company can actually do this. And really, I've seen some of the parameters they put into their operations, and really safety thinking thing. And they're just about to unveil the heaviest lift rocket since the Saturn V rocket.
Wow. What do you make of all of this, Professor Fisher?
Well, I think that space privatization is inevitable, and I think, in fact, that NASA's supporting that. So there are some calls for funding and so forth where private companies are encouraged to participate. So it's an exciting development.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about, both of you, the next flight vehicle, what would you like our next flight vehicle to be? What's necessary? What do we need to develop?
Well, I would like it to be very, to be able to change its mode of operation, whether it has to lift cargo and people, and to do that all in the same launch vehicle. We technically, with the retirement of the space shuttle, we really don't need a space shuttle anymore once the space station is complete. Because it was our heavy lift vehicle. It was our U-Haul van to get stuff into space. It was our U-Haul van to get the Hubble Space Telescope up into space. The Hubble Space Telescope was designed to barely fit into the cargo bay. The pieces of the International Space Station were designed to fit in the cargo bay. They couldn't be bigger. They could be smaller, but it was always maximized. Now that we're into this mode of just taking people up to the station, the space shuttle was probably overkill. You don't need to have all this. You don't want to take your U-Haul truck to drop your kid off at school.
Right.
So that next vehicle needs to be adjustable to maybe do Earth orbit, maybe go beyond, maybe be able to head to the moon if you have a heavy lift vehicle, or beyond. So something that is designed well, and even when you go back into the 1960s, a lot of the rocket engineers didn't think the Saturn V rocket was the good design for us to stay in space. It was the perfect design to get us to the moon first.
Mm-hmm. Professor Fisher.
Well, I think that having some kind of a space vehicle is important, because without it, it's going to limit the science that we can do. And it's true that one of the jobs of the shuttle is to go to the International Space Station, where we have partners in other countries and so forth. But it's also, I think, about learning how human beings respond to low-gravity environments. So if we ever imagine that we're going to send a space crew to, again, to the moon, for example, or again to Mars, then, you know, this is part of the homework that we have to do to figure out how to get people there safely.
Let's go. Thank you both for your responses to Paul in Whitewater. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
My name is Paul Ribsky. I'm an astronomical spectroscopist, but I do all my spectroscopy from the ground. I'm with UW Whitewater.
Could you tell me more about your job? What is that? You're an astronomical what?
I'm an astronomical spectroscopist. So my question is about what Dr. Fisher said about determining or finding planets by looking for the spectroscopic signature of cyanogen, of oxygen. And my concern is strictly signal-to-noise ratio, how easy it will be to look at a planet with as small an atmosphere as an Earth-like planet against the background of the intense near-infrared spectrum from the stars around which this planet will orbit. Will, for example, the Webb telescope be capable of getting a sufficient amount of light such that spectrographs on that instrument will be able to see the near-infrared spectra, for example, of oxygen or in cyanogen?
Right. So as Mr. Risky says, this is going to be a heroic effort on the part of, you know, NASA and U.S. astronomers. But there are a couple of ways that we're thinking of doing it. So the obvious thing is, you know, you go up and you try somehow to image the planet sitting next to a star. And, you know, the angular separation is very small because the stars and the planets are so far away. And so maybe we can do that. Maybe, you know, the hope is that with a flagship mission that will launch in a decade or two decades from now, that we'll be able to find a way to know out the light of the star. There are a lot of really clever ideas on the table for how we can do that. And then we'll be able to see the planet orbiting the star without the glare of the star itself. But there's another technique that's actually already been used to measure spectra of planets themselves. And it's in the case where we have this very lucky arrangement. It doesn't happen very often, but sometimes we see planets that transit in front of and behind their host stars. And again, this is what the Kepler mission is doing, is looking for transiting planets rather than planets that are actually, you know, that rather than using the Doppler technique or the spectroscopic techniques that Mr. Rivsky described. And so in this case, where the planet goes behind its star, it means that for 1 second, we have an image that we'll take of the combined light of the star plus the planet. We can't resolve either one of those. We know that they're just both of the data, you know, the data from both the planet and the star are being dumped into our data bucket. That's all we know. But then when the planet goes behind the star, the contribution from the planet disappears completely. And so now we can take our combined data bucket and divide it by the observation of the star only, the one where we know the planet isn't there. And then what we see left behind is the residual contribution from the planet alone. So these are two techniques, you know, trying to image the planet and then also looking at transiting planets to try to remove the signal from the star that astronomers are using to try to tease out the signals. And it's not going to be easy. It really is a heroic effort, and it's going to require a dedicated effort.
Hmm. Anything else, Paul?
A quick follow-up on that, if I could.
Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Is that going to be a dedicated telescope, or will the Webb telescope have sufficient aperture to gather light of sufficient signal-to-noise ratio do that division?
It's. I think we always learn. I think it's a little frustrating for the public, but we're learning as we go. And so, if I can just point to the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is flying now, you know, no one ever expected that Spitzer would be able to do the science that it's done already, which is imaging the atmospheres of gas giant planets. But we figured it out along the way. So I think the answer is that, yes, the James Webb Space Telescope is going to have sufficient aperture. It's large enough in size. And we'll figure out a way either by using an occulting device that's further away to block out the star, kind of like, you know, when you're playing tennis and you have the unlucky side of the court that's staring into the sun, and when the ball's coming up over the net, you hold your hand up to block the sunlight, and then you can see the little tennis ball coming toward you. So we're thinking about techniques like that. And yeah, I think James Webb Space Telescope is going to be a great instrument to do some of this work. But to actually null out the light from the star is a more ambitious task, and that's going to require a separate flagship mission from NASA. It's not on the table yet.
Thank you, Paul, very much for the call. And before we go to more phone calls, I want to spend a few moments on Hubble, too. And if you, Alan, would talk about the glorious pictures and the amazing work that Hubble has done for how many years now?
Oh, the Hubble's been wow. Wow, you'd throw that math on me right now.
it's history. It's not math. So
right, well, I know. It's been up since the early 1990s.
Has so it? That's a long time.
It's been a long time, but everything that it has done, even from its earliest point when it had its spherical aberration on its mirror, even at that point, it was showing us stuff that we couldn't see from Earth. And now it just continues to break the rules of astronomy, and for every question it answers, it creates a bunch of other questions that we will have to spend time to figure out. And hopefully, this next generation Webb scope that's going with the Webb Space Telescope will help us find more information about the universe. And it's the science it has given back to us has been amazing. And every day we use images of it in our shows of what it showed us, and the pictures are so amazing. They're photogenic. It sees in the optical in the same way our eyes see. So
yes,
can really appreciate the pictures.
Yeah. Oh, they are just gorgeous. Every now and then I go to that web and just look at the pictures. They're beautiful. Two more phone calls in one moment. We're talking about all the latest from space, from the anniversary of Yuri Gagarin to what we've learned from Hubble to the end of the next flight vehicle will be, to the end of the space shuttles, and to this wonderful participatory program that one of our guests is founded, Planet Hunters, in which you can help find exoplanets and determine whether or not they are planets. We have yet to talk about what's in the spring sky, which is always good. We'll talk about that. Here's our phone number. A couple lines are open for you, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our guests are Professor Deborah Fisher, a professor of astronomy with an emphasis on the detection and characterization of exoplanets. She's at Yale University, and she's co-creator of planethunters.org. Alan Pesch, director of the Barlow Planetarium, and their website is uwfox.uwc.edu/Barlow, or you can just Google Barlow Planetarium, which might be easier too, and you'll find it. To your phone calls, more of them in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we'll be talking about Afghanistan, and our guest is the author of The Wrong Way. Bing West will be joining us. We thought we would look at the military budget tomorrow as well. At this time when we're trying to cut costs, are there ways to cut a military budget? And we'll look at that tomorrow. All right, back to phone calls. Randy on the road is next. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate the good subject matter and your guests as well today.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to go back to when we were talking about finding those planets in the Goldilocks zone. Yeah, I'm familiar with the Goldilocks zone, but one concern I have is every time we talk about finding other life, we always think of it chauvinistically in terms of, you know, what we know as carbon-based life forms. I'm just wondering if your guests could comment on those chauvinisms, given that, you know, other elements could certainly go through life-giving chemical reactions, given the right circumstances. And I was just wondering if they could comment on any of that and I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Thank you, Randy. Let's start with you, Deborah Fisher.
Hi. Yes, definitely. So I could give a whole lecture on carbon-based life. One of the other popular elements that's been suggested is silicon, which is in the same column of the periodic table of elements and can form similar but not as many bonds as carbon. I'm actually going to put my money on carbon-based life. I think it's not entirely chauvinistic. It's just that when biologists and chemists look at the sorts of bonds that carbon can form, it's much more flexible. I mean, we can form double bonds, single bonds, triple bonds, long hydrocarbon bonds, which are important for the formation of RNA and DNA. And so I think carbon-based, and the other thing is that carbon is incredibly abundant. It's something like the fourth most abundant element in the universe. And so there's a lot of it. And its favorite solvent is water, and hydrogen and oxygen are other incredibly abundant elements in the universe. So it's true that we're very narrow in our focus right now, looking for small rocky planets that might host liquid water. But part of that is that's how we know, you know, that's the type of life that we can recognize on Earth is the kind of life that we'll recognize somewhere else. And so we might look very hard for other types of life forms, but just not be able to recognize them because our vision isn't really broad enough yet. So I think by starting with what we know and then sort of, you know, growing out from there is actually a kind of a smart and thrifty strategy.
Thanks very much for the call. Ahmed is next in Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi. I'm kind of calling to bring up a point that was brought up earlier in the show, and still it's more related to that disability of distance. Quite often we measure the space program in terms of how many dollars it brings back, in terms of how much we've invested in it. And, you know, there's something to be said about the human need to know and the human desire to understand the universe in which we live and understand ourselves that I think has to be measured beyond dollars. And
okay, I think we got the gist of what you're saying. Your phone is terrible. I'm sorry, but the human need to know. I understand. We have to do it. What's on top of the mountain? Alan?
I completely agree, and that's... It always comes down to dollars and cents, but you know what? As I was growing up as a kid, we would disappear for a day exploring what was up the river. Even today, whenever we go to a new town and staying in a new hotel, whether it is at Wisconsin Dells or Washington or New York, my daughter will wake me up in the hotel room every morning and say, we need to go explore the hotel. And it's just... understanding what's around us, and then that increases to going around outside. And I think every creature wants to explain or understand what's happening around them, and it's very satisfying. Even if you discover something small or find out something you haven't found out before, it's satisfying, and you never know when you're going to make that discovery of something that's going to change how you feel or what might change the entire world or how they look at things.
Mm-hmm. I like to ask people who are in certain fields, and this is one of them, was it staring at the sky when you were a kid or how you got into it? And let me go to you on that. I haven't heard your story, Deborah.
So I think when I was a kid, you know, my introduction to science was through science fiction. So I loved, you know, reading science fiction and reading about mad scientists working in basements and, you know, thinking about blowing things up. That all seemed very cool and interesting to me. But you know, it didn't seem very practical for me to go into astronomy. And so I worked my way into it accidentally. It's not the story most people like to hear. They like to, you know, hear that when you were 12 years old, you got the telescope that you loved. And that's
right,
certainly
right.
For a lot of people. But, yeah.
Hmm. And Alan, for you?
I like knowing things. I always have, and I've always enjoyed science and physics and mathematics. And astronomy, for astronomy, the physics and the math is the language that we use in astronomy. So I've always enjoyed sharing that information and telling anybody who wants to listen to me about it and how exciting it is and what you can see. And that just went into education, and the planetarium world is just a very cool teacher in a very cool classroom.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Joel in Middleton. Hi, Joel.
Hi there.
Hi.
My question is about I don't know if it was actually proposed, if it was in process, whatever, but it was a space-based telescope that was going to be an array of mirrors in space that would be independently positioned but digitally connected, and it would have been huge and had a resolution that exceeded Hubble by far. And I was wondering if your guests knew about that and if it's actually going to happen, if it's beyond the proposal stage.
Right. So I can comment on that. Your caller is talking about the terrestrial planet finder, in particular in its interferometric mode, where there would have been several telescopes, as he said, that were connected and phased up with light, with lasers. And that was part of the NASA program that actually died as the financial hardship and realities began to set in. I think that the European community is going ahead with a mission called Darwin. There's certainly, it hasn't been approved yet, but they're certainly still talking about it. And so it may be that as we move to these next space projects, they're just far too expensive for the United States to take on alone. And so what we're doing is beginning to actually collaborate with other countries, with the United States having a clear role, with the other countries having a clear role. And then maybe together, you know, this world community can start to do some of the ambitious science that we wanted to do. But so the terrestrial planet finder is no longer on the books at all at NASA.
Thanks, Joel, for the call. Spring sky. What's in the spring sky, Alan?
Oh, well, you know what? It's very happy to report that the jewel of the solar system, the second largest planet in the solar system, is now back in our sky. It's Saturn, and if you look at the eastern sky right after sunset, you can see a couple bright stars there. The higher one is actually Saturn, and it'll be in our sky for the entire summer pretty much, and we'll be watching it through our telescopes and our family astronomy nights. And it's always nice to know when you look at that little dot in the sky, we have a robot going around that planet called Cassini that is sending amazing images of Saturn back over the past almost 10 years now. It's coming up on it, and the images are great, and it's nice to have Saturn. And if you've never seen Saturn through a telescope, it's one of those things you remember. I remember the first time I saw Saturn.
Alan.
It's not a picture. You're actually looking at the real photon
coming
from the planet.
Yeah, that's great. We have an email, somebody who wanted to know about a comet that will pass by this summer called Elenin. Is that it?
Oh, boy. I'm a little bit out of comets right now, but I'll do some research on it. I'm sure we have automatic detectors for discovering comets, and I'm sure somebody's created the orbit. So I don't know how bright it's going to be. Sometimes when we get these information on comets, that they might look okay through a telescope, but they're not as anything as spectacular as Hale-Bopp was, or Yakutake, or some of the other great comets in the past.
Yeah. Do you go out and look at the sky every month or every night, Professor Fisher?
Oh, definitely. I go to the observatories quite a bit. I work in Chile, up in the Andes. I work in Hawaii, on Mauna Kea. And, you know, those are incredible sites that are far away from civilization. So the view of the night sky is incredible. There have been times when I've seen my shadow cast on a moonless night just from the glow of the Milky Way galaxy.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. And, Alan, why don't you just give us, we have about a minute left, a little enticement of what's going on in terms of programs this summer for young people, or what show you have right now?
Well, we have a couple shows running right now. We have Ringworld, which is about the Saturn, of how we got to Saturn and the images we're going to be taking at Saturn. We have kind of a fun constellation family show called Bear Tales and Other Grizzly Stories, which talks about the constellations Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, the Big and Little Bear, among some other things. And, of course, this summer we have our summer camps for kids, Wisconsin Space Academy, which does rocket launching on three levels. And we also have Wisconsin Astronomy Academy, where we will provide optical instruments, whether binoculars or small telescopes.
Wonderful.
And even a reflector for kids that come to our classes.
Wonderful. I want to be a kid again. I would love to do that, but I can't be a kid again. Thank you both so much. It was really such an informative and inspirational in many ways hour. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Our thanks to Professor Deborah Fisher. She's a professor of astronomy and has started this whole program. Please go there if you would like to participate. Planet Hunters. The website is planethunters.org. She has a special emphasis on the detection and characterization of exoplanets. Alan Pesch, of course, you could call him a semi-regular here on the show. He's the director of the Barlow Planetarium, which is on the campus of the University of Wisconsin, Fox Valley. And it's a really wonderful place. And they have these great programs going on this summer for young people, too. What a wonderful thing to do if you're in grade school to go and study in the stars and use telescopes and binoculars and all of that. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 on the Ideas Network.